Hey, you know what? Five times a charm. You know how much we love the Aftershock's bone conductive headphones for running.
I love them because it leaves you open to the environment, Scott. The music goes through the bone in your head and the other sounds go right to your ears where you need it.
It makes your trail running safe. And they just released a new one called the AeroPex, AeroPex.
And it's lightweight, less than 1 ounce, Scott, so you can't even feel them.
The battery life has been increased up to 8 hours.
That includes music, calls, audiobooks, podcasts for 10 days standby time as well.
And if you're using it for taking phone calls and stuff like that, it now has a dual noise-canceling mics, which minimize that surround sound.
Fully charges in 2 hours.
If you have never tried these are the greatest headphones ever. There's different types. There's the Trex Air. There is the Trex Titanium. And now the new Trex AeroPex. You can get a deal by going to our partners page and clicking on the banner. You get $55 off their bundle.
Exoskin. Exoskin.com when it really counts.
We have Bob Crowley here who successfully completed the Tour de France in 2019. Bob, tell us your experience with Exoskin.
You know, in 2018, I didn't finish the tour. I got about halfway and my feet were in agony, totally chopped up. 2019, made it 6 days, 143 hours, finished the race with one pair of Exoskin toe socks and not a mark on my feet. Incredible 180 degree turnaround in just 1 year, and had the same experience with no chafing, no issues whatsoever with their top, and it cooled me in the day and warmed me in the night.
When it comes to a race, your feet can take you to the finish line or it can take you out. And when you put them in Exoskin toe socks, they really work.
Eliminate that variable. Get yourself a pair. Go to our partners page. Click on the Exoskin banner. Get 20% off. Use the code TRN.
Yeah, thank you, Don. You know, I mean, I didn't know what it was going to be like. You know, you sound like a nice guy on this podcast, but...
But I know it's on the upper edge, and you guys have won a couple of awards, and...
I've never prepped for a podcast ever.
Oh, that's what you're doing.
What are you balancing your checkbook over there, AJW? What's going on?
Yeah.
You're recording this, aren't you, Freeman?
I get everything. All right. Are we ready?
Yeah.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I jumped in front of Scott because he was giving me a hard time, and I'm Don Freeman.
I'm Scott Warr, and we have Patrick Regan with us here today, and boy, he has really had a couple really good years of ultra running. He's... won Javelina 100 the last 2 years. He's going back the end of October to defend his two-time title at Javelina 100. I want to know, so Javelina 100 is in the desert. It's hot, and you're a guy from Savannah, Georgia. How does that work out? Humid, hot, to arid, hot. How do you prepare for that in Savannah, Georgia?
Yeah, it's an interesting race. I'd originally got roped in by Zach Bitter, who said, "Hey, it's a great first 100."
And yeah, you can't trust Zach.
you can't trust Zach. That's he's like, "I'm running too, so it'll be perfect." And we went out at about, I don't know, 6:45 pace or something like that for the first loop. So it was a really interesting introduction to all, you know, ultra running in terms of running hundreds. I like the race just because it aligns well with the kind of heat. And if you look at like the arid weather there compared to the heat and humidity here, I think it aligns really well with what my climate can prepare me for. So
I've seen some videos of you running Javelina 100, and one of the things I just kind of laughed at is, boy, every aid station, you are just pouring water all over you. I'm thinking, are you trying to create a humid climate, microclimate around your own body there?
Yeah, make it feel for sure. Home? Making it feel as much like home as possible, I guess. That's the key there. That was at least what Zach taught me the first year. It was just stay as wet as possible going out of aid, because 2 miles later, man, you're bone dry. You know, it's an interesting race in that there's no shade. So whatever you dumped on yourself in that aid station, probably other than, I don't know, your gaiters and your shoes, you're going to be bone dry 2 miles, 3 miles later.
You've been strong at a lot of different distances. At what point did you think, I want to stretch this out, I want to do more than a marathon? What clicked for you?
I'd say my second marathon. When I don't know, man, there was something about the marathon I wasn't so much enjoying pictures, and the distance, the speed at which I was running, every moment of it felt a little stressful to me. And I had a feeling that based on some of the longer trail runs I'd been doing on the East Coast, you know, closer to 5 or 6 hour efforts up in the mountains, I was enjoying that a lot more than the actual races I was doing. So at that point, I decided to transition directly from trials into my first 100K. And man, I never looked back, you know. I haven't run another marathon since. So it's, I really enjoy it and love every minute of being out there for 100K to 100 miles specifically.
Yeah. So what happened at that 100K, that first 100K that got you hooked? What did you experience there that made you think, I think I like this longer stuff?
I think it was particularly like the last 30% of the race when, yeah, I expected this big bonk to a degree because it was over twice as far as I'd ever run in a race, you know? And I only turned it on more and more as the race went. Like, the fueling felt super smooth. The last 20% of the race was actually like my fastest 20% of the race. And I'd never hit a point where I wasn't able to continue pushing the nutrition I needed to keep running at that pace, you know? So I think at that point I knew there was something special there for me in terms of, I like the pace a lot more and I'm really enjoying the atmosphere a lot more. And I feel like I was just better at that discipline than I was at the marathon, you know? And that's encouraging as well. Like being able to, you know, make a US team, that year in the road 100K world champs was really special. Like, I could have never made a US team in the marathon. But to make a team, that was assurance that I'm on track to something that could turn into, you know, a professional career doing it. So
did you have somebody or a friend that had run these longer distances, or did you talk to anybody that said, this is how you approach 100K, or were you on the starting line and take off at marathon pace? How did you prepare for something like that mentally?
I have to think back to that time. I mean, my buddy, Morgan Elliott, who's a skyrunner, I don't know if you guys have ever chatted with him. He ran States this year. It was his first 100. And Morgan had been taking me out on the trails pretty often in Appalachia. We'd done the Art Lobe, which is like a 30-mile run point to point up in Black Mountain, Asheville, North Carolina area. And my buddy Andrew Snope, he's a local Savannah runner here, and he'd done, I think as far at that point as Vol State. So he'd done Vol State 500K, 24-hour track races. He's doing Spartathlon this weekend. So Andrew had really given me the bug. From there, I'd basically just kind of extrapolated what I thought was possible in the 100K based on what I was capable of in the marathon. And I think my coaching background had made that a little easy, you know, to kind of look at it and say, hey, like, if you can run this pace for the half, this pace for the full, we should be able to stretch that to about this pace for the 100K. And it worked out in a pretty linear way. I was able to kind of nail it on my first one just by running super smart in the first 50%. So
now I happen to have the opportunity to be out here at that 100K challenge. And one of the things that I took away with, I even told you, Scott, that Patrick Reagan has the best attitude of anybody out there, because every time you passed or I happened to be going the other way, not that I was running, but I was going the other way.
He was running to catch up.
and you were always greeting and saying hello and so positive, and it didn't matter if you knew them or not because you didn't know me. And you were just very, very kind and so nice and so upbeat. And I was just really impressed with that attitude and that characteristic of yours. Not only a fast runner, but just a good, good human.
Thanks. I mean, that's what I'd always experienced from going to sea trail races and, you know, seeing really positive, really energetic folks like Courtney DeWalter, dude. Like,
oh, yeah.
You know, she comes by, she's talking to everybody. And as much as you think, well, she's communicating to enjoy a conversation with you, that's also a lot of positive energy coming back at you that distracts you from like how much pain you're going through, right? So to me, it is that personal connection, that appreciation of engaging with each other. The people volunteering, the people out there supporting and enjoying the sport in the way you are, but it's also a distraction from what kind of hell I'm through moment.
Yeah, when you put that positive energy out, it just does bounce back at you. But I've got one observation with you and Courtney both. You guys move so fast that you really don't have to spend much time with the people you're talking with. So to engage for me might mean 2 hours worth of engagement. But for you, it's like, you know, two to four seconds.
It's a hi, how are you? Versus, let me tell you about this funny anecdote that happened to me last weekend.
Yeah, let me tell you about my dog. Yeah.
Hey, so you've been coaching. You started running cross country and you've coached cross country. How did you get into running as a Ute?
Yeah, I'd never been pushed into it, but I'd always heard stories. My dad ran in his 30s with some really high level guys in Western PA, including Donnie Norman, who was a 2:11 marathoner. He'd been top 10 at trials 2 or 3 times, and my dad got into running later in life, but really enjoyed it. And I said, man, you know, if I'd had cross country in high school, I think I'd have done that instead of played football. Like, I loved running in my 30s. And I think that bug kind of hit me at the tail end of when, obviously, as a 5'7" guy, my basketball career was maybe over when I was a freshman in high school. I think that was a blessing in disguise there, where, you know, you kind of get forced off of a team based on not getting playing time. It's discouraging. And that's when I found running was in this interesting way, where I'd run a gym class mile, and before I knew it, I was running track and field. And 2 years later, I was running cross country as a junior in high school. So for my dad, I think, to see me find running in this organic way rather than for him to push me into it, always made me feel like that, you know, there was a reason, like, I found it and running found me. And I was fortunate to run at university and have a somewhat successful career there and really get into cross country in particular. Had a great track and field team and a good experience up in Northwestern PA. And from there, it got out of the sport for some years before finding my way back into coaching. So, yeah, it's a pretty organic way to find it. No one had ever just pushed me into it and said, hey, this is a sport you need to do that I want you to do, you know. So
let's go from running at the university to then graduating and you know, going into real life, and then all of a sudden ending up on Team Hoka. Kind of walk us through some of that. How does that happen? Because not everybody that is out there listening has had that opportunity or experience. So how did it work for you?
Man, it was a pretty interesting road. I think, I've told this story on a few podcasts of how I'd stepped away from running and got back into it. But I spent a few years traveling and playing in ragtime and jazz bands after university. I played percussion and rhythm strings in particular. And the groups I played with, we went through maybe 36 or 38 different states playing.
Wow.
Enjoyed ourselves doing that, and it was interesting for me because it was a step totally away from what I'd studied at university, like a step completely away from my running. But as running had found me before, like, it found me again when I landed back in Savannah. I was fortunate to get the assistant coaching job at the university, coaching cross country here, and then I applied for the head coaching job at Savannah College of Art and Design, and I worked the head coaching job there, coaching cross country for 7 years. And somewhere along the way there, you know, I'd found that I was super interested in training and running again, and had met a couple guys in the area that were passionate about ultra running. And before you know it, I transitioned from, you know, just training with my guys and running, you know, the same distance races I was in college, really, like 5Ks, 10Ks, 8Ks, half marathon, into, you know, focusing on ultra running. So it was an interesting path. Like, it's not, I don't think I just had the linear experience of run collegiate, you know, run in high school, run collegiately, run professionally. for me, it was this winding path that led me back to running. And when Hoka had sought me out after the World Championship in 2016, I knew I was on for sure. Like, you know, it was something I wanted to do and see out and see what was possible moving forward. So
what happens, because many of us aren't on your team, as you look around, there's not as many team runners as there are, you know, people signing up for a race. What shows up at your doorstep? A box full of Hoka shoes and a hat and a shirt, or how does that go down?
Like, you know, we go through different prototypes. That's always fun of, you know, communicating with the brain on a consistent basis on a prototype. Like for Carbon X in particular, we'd done multiple iterations of that shoe in the approach to the event that we ran in Sacramento, California. So that is one of my favorite things to do, is work consistently with a prototype, with innovation and design. And for, say, me and Wamsley and Sabrina Little and Hideki and all these men and women to come together and say, these are the ways you can make this shoe better before it comes to production. I think that's one of my favorite parts of being involved with the brand, is how heavily we're involved with innovation when it comes to a shoe like the Carbon X or like a trail running shoe. I really like getting the prototypes. I mean, that's kind of cool, because there may only be 10 or 15 pair of them existing, and you're trying to get them right for the majority of the population. But in addition, you know, we have a B2B, so, you know, just like a vendor, like I can get on and say, these are the shoes I need, and they show up at the doorstep. So
nice.
It's pretty awesome. And we're always getting cool kit. And, yeah, this year we're going to have our first athlete summit in December. So we'll all be hanging out together in one spot for 3 days, you know, talking about the brand and talking about the vision of the company and training together. So it's cool. You know, it's a cool company to be involved with, in that running is the thing we do. So, you know, you run for some brands and running is a very small sector of their company, but that's everything for Hoka. So,
hey, I want to thank you for helping come up with a Carbon X, because I have that shoe, and that shoe has been integral in getting me back on the roads to run. I admittedly was a trail snob, and if I didn't have the time to go to the trail, I didn't run. Getting the Carbon X, and I love that shoe, it got me to the point where I said, you know what, I can go for a little run just out my front door here and be on the roads, and you know what, it's okay, and it can actually be kind of fun. So thank you for giving that motivation to me.
Yeah, sure. It turned out to be such a great shoe. And I mean, you know, running out of the box basically for 100K, or, you know, if it gets you back on the roads, you know, days you can't make it to the trail, that's what it's all about. So
out of the box, running 100K, as this 100K challenge unfolded, it was very top secret until just right before the event. And I have the impression, I don't know if this is true, that the athletes showed up, and it sounds like you did a little of the research and development for the shoe, but did you have a pair of Carbon X that you were able to train in, or did you take them out of the box and run 100K for a record?
Yeah, we each had some pairs that, you know, we were breaking in. There were a couple different, you know, makes and models that we were working with at that juncture. And one of the pairs, I put 50 miles on them. Sure. I didn't just get them straight out the box.
Okay. I got the impression that you guys showed up in Sacramento at the airport, and they drove you to the hotel and said, oh, by the way, this is what you're running in today. And you take the shoes out of the box and lace them up for the first time the morning that you guys started.
Now, what was different about that was the start line was just so business-like. Everybody was there, was just, you know, on their game, focused. There wasn't a bunch of chatter. There wasn't a bunch of music. There wasn't a bunch of announcer, you know, trying to get people ready to go and tell them what color flags they were following. This was just all business. You guys were out there to get something done.
For sure. It was a really interesting experience. I mean, you saw it firsthand in that this was a brand-oriented event, and it was also an audacious challenge. Like, I mean, I was trying to break Max's American record. Jim was trying to break the world record for 100K and 50 miles. Sabrina was, you know, going for sub 7 hours. I mean, it was pretty audacious goals. And you know, there's only eight of us out there. It's not like you're running in a big pack. So, you know, as people that are running with you, you know, it's like Sage and Chris Brown were running with me for up to 35 and 40 miles. As they peel off, it's you and the pavement. I mean, it was a unique, very cool event. And I think I would do something like that again. You know, it was interesting. I liked it a lot.
Well, you might know what's next. Are you letting something out of the bag there? I don't know.
Yeah. Would you like to make any special announcements for Hoka?
No, we won't push you on that.
I don't think I should. Yeah. McManus might. Hey, what kind of announcement did you make on Trail Runner Podcast?
One of the things when I think about Patrick is I think about your gait. Did you need to work on that gait? Is that something that your father handed down to you with his running? Is it come natural, or do you work on it?
Yeah, I work on it, but in a very organic way. I mean, I do a lot of efficiency economy work, which is what like Magda would call it, or I would call it, in terms of doing a lot of strides, still incorporating a decent bit of marathon and half marathon pace training into my running on a regular basis during certain cycles and phases of my training. So as much as I'd like to say that's just natural and how it flows, it does take a lot of particular work injected in the training throughout particular training blocks. Like we did a lot of marathon pace work, half marathon pace work approaching the Carbon X project and even approaching Western States this year to make sure my cadence was in a particular spot, you know? And as the season evolves, my cadence gets closer and closer to 184, 186 steps a minute. And that's kind of my bread and butter, where you don't get too much vertical displacement. You're taking a lot of steps per minute, so that there's just hardly any wasted energy. Yeah.
How does ragtime percussion play into your stride work? Does that rhythm help, you think?
I think I naturally, you know, I picked up music later in life, and I think my running had sort of integrated directly into that, where I understood rhythm and pacing and stride work, and that flowed directly into me just learning a new medium. Like for me, it was, I'd pick up an instrument and then everything was a washboard with strings to me, right? Do you know what I mean? Where I played a lot of washboard percussion, and any instrument I pick up, as soon as I knew the chords, I'd say, hey, like I understand this rhythm. And I think that all comes back to my running, right? Huh. And vice versa, where understanding rhythm, understanding the importance of cadence, pacing, proper stride length. Yeah. It all relates to everything else, you know, it's like this big hive mind to me. So,
yeah. So forgive me, I'm not a ragtime enthusiast, but as you said, washboard
and what strings,
washboard rhythm. Am I picturing you with an old time washboard and some thumbtacks on your fingers? Is that what you're doing?
Yeah, basically. I mean, I played washboard percussion with like banjo finger picks. So like the same picks that you would use for like three finger style, like Scruggs banjo or three finger style, like ragtime guitar, where you're using the thumb, the middle and the index finger to play your patterns. Uh-huh. I'd do the same thing, but with just eight finger picks on, yeah, all fingers.
Patrick, by chance, do you play the spoons or the jug?
I'm not a jug or spoons player. I can't claim that, you know, but that would be the full suite.
Yeah, there, you if you picked it up and you could understand the chords, I think you'd be fine.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Hey Patrick, sure. I want somewhere out there in your hard drive is a video of you playing. I would like to ask you for that video, and we can attach it to the podcast. I'm actually really interested in seeing you do that.
sure. I could probably share a few tracks with you guys too.
We'll make it our close on this podcast. We'll get a little Patrick's ragtime going.
You know, let's get beyond the ragtime here for a minute. You know, one of the other things that I'm interested in is your relationship with the Comrades Marathon. You know, you have one of the fastest American times over at Comrades, back in 2017. I think you were the 12th 12th place, which was the fastest American finisher. Tell us a little bit about your relationship with Comrades.
Yeah, I pretty naturally flowed into that event after doing a couple road 100Ks and reached out to Ned Bank, which is one of the major clubs that will support you to come to Comrades, because it's a tricky race to go support yourself. So after the 100K World Championships in 2016, I reached out to Ned Bank. I decided that it was definitely a race I wanted to run. At that point, I'd been running a couple editions of the Ultra Vasan too. So the Swedish guys that I ran Ultra Vasan with and the race director there had encouraged me Comrades would be a great fit. So that was the next natural step for me in the ultra running world, was to go to a really big competitive ultra. And that one in particular, I mean, you line up with 20,000 people. It's insane. 20,000 people running 55 miles. So I would love to get back there. The problem is the timing with the Western states and the Comrades. It's virtually impossible, I think, to do both well in the same year for me. But it's a magical experience. I mean, I would do 10 of them in a row if I could. But now I've got the Western States bug. So,
right. Hey, if you were to, create the perfect race for Patrick, what would it look like? Would it be on a track? Would it be a lot of hill climbing? Would it be a mixture? What's the perfect course for you? And maybe it's already out there and you've run it, or you have your eye on it, or maybe you need to create a course like, Arnold Palmer. I think he created some of his own courses for golf. He's the only one that knew where the hole was. That's why he did so well.
Yeah, that's right. That's why I did so well. It's interesting that answer like would change and probably has changed over time. I would have probably said at one point like 100K, 10 by 10K on the road, you know, similar to the Carbon X or the 100K World Championships. And I might have said Javelina 100 a year ago, but maybe now I'm gravitating more towards states. It's so difficult for me to say at this juncture, is that I've only done one states. I feel like right now Javelina is probably the perfect course for me, just because it's so flat and runnable compared to all the other races, and you have the heat aspect. I would say right now probably Javelina. But I'd like to think that a course like Spartathlon or Badwater would be maybe the ideal longer race for me. There's certain junctures in Western where I feel like Jim, Jared, Mark Hammond, Bronco Billy, like these guys, Charmin, like some of those guys can just move better than me through certain sections, especially downhill sections in that course. But I'd like to think over time that maybe Western could be a perfect race for me as well.
And maybe that's good that you have all these different times that you are attracted to certain races, because it keeps you energized, it keeps you passionate, it keeps you on point, and you don't have to set the alarm in the morning to get up. You're just ready to go.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. I mean, I like running a lot of different types of races in particular. I think when I first got into the sport, I was running the same types of races over and over, you know, flatter, 50 mile, 100K, very runnable races. But now I'm interested in other things. I mean, I had a chance to go do OCC at the UTMB this year, which is totally outside my comfort zone, but kind of gave me the UTMB bug a little bit. Like, I don't know, man. I mean, I like that kind of climbing. So as long as it's 100K or more, it's my thing. So,
and it keeps training fresh too, because you have to train differently for each one of those types of events. So I think that's good.
Yeah.
What are some of the things that you're working on in your personal training? You mentioned that Magna Boulay has been your coach. What are your strengths in running, and then what are some of the things that you're working on to become a better, well-rounded runner?
Sure. Yeah, where I live definitely allows me to be just super strong on the flats. You know, in particular, I can dive into little segments of marathon pace or half marathon pace training, and that's re-injected back into my muscle memory, you know. But a few things that are tough for me based on where I live in such a flat place are running fast downhill, running fast through technical downhills. So some things that we do to really get my quads ready for that type of running is a lot of weight vest training, where we're loading the quads eccentrically with a heavier weight vest on. So over the course of the past year, we've been doing a lot more power hiking on a treadmill, a lot more loading of the quads and strengthening long term to develop more muscle and quadriceps. And I think those are the things that are going to help me, because I can't engage too much in downhill running right out my door at home. I don't have a lot of technical trails here, so that's in particular why I gravitate more towards non-technical races. I can quadriceps such a way that you can kind of mimic downhill running even if you don't have a lot of it, but it's very difficult to learn how to run technical downhills without running on this on a regular basis. So those are my goals. Just learn how to run faster downhill to prepare for Western States. Now I'm kind of like a single-minded guy, I guess. I'm like 300 days out thinking Western States.
I love it. It's been fun listening to you over the last half hour and how you kind of gravitate back to Western States. An eighth place finish, by the way, this year, and an automatic entry into the 2020 Western States. And it sounds like you are focused.
Yeah, I'm now building my schedule in such a way that is allowing me to learn more about the 100-mile discipline far enough out from Western States, and then building my schedule in the 6 months approaching Western States so that I have the most possible energy in my legs on race day, you know? So I've built a pretty cool schedule where I'll do a few hundreds this fall, and then my two races approaching States are, designed so that I have the best day at States I could possibly can. So
you entered Western States last year. What did you learn from it? What did you take away that you'll bring back to 2020 that will help you improve? Because that's what our goals are, obviously, to improve.
Sure, of course. I planned this year to have a very conservative high country, and I just happened to find myself right around like Ian Sherman, Jeff Browning, Cal Petari, Chris Brown, who are, in my opinion, some of the best guys you can learn to run Western States from. So I spent the high country with those guys. Me and Bronco, we just yo-yoed all day. And a few things that I saw was, me and Bronco, we tended to hike a lot of the same things. He tended to blow me away on the downhills, and I tended to catch him on the flats. So I noticed in particular that something I really have to work on are those downhills there. And I think that from taking it easy enough in the high country, from being really smart about all my lines of play all the way till Devil's Thumb, and not even like hitting the gas too hard in Forest Hill, but starting to hit the gas at the river, it gave me the concept of like, if I felt as good as I did at the river this year and as good as I did at Pointed Rocks, maybe I can run a little harder a little earlier. And I think that's what me and Magda have taken away, is I can probably run about maybe 8 minutes faster from Thumb to Forest Hill, 6 minutes faster from Forest Hill to the river. We're starting to now piece together, based on splits and based on how much I had left at States this year, where I can make up maybe 25 or 30 minutes this year, So we're thinking we can find, maybe another, somewhere between another 15 and 30 minutes. I think it's out there. And I think I ran a conservative enough race this year to find those minutes. So that'd be that's always the goal, is to improve on placement, to improve on, your time on, from the race the year before, but more importantly to me, to just have another good States, another positive experience,
I would think that if the stars aligned and it becomes one of those heat fests, my guess would be that you would do really well in the canyons when it's, 110 degrees plus. I'm not going to wish that on you, but I'm just speculating. I have a question.
Well, Scott, to your point, there are runners like Ian Sherman that we've talked to that hope for a little adversity. The more adversity, the hotter it is, the better his his skill set aligns for a higher finish.
And more people make mistakes. Right,
right. Right. Yeah.
He's talked about that in the past.
And I'm going to keep interrupting, Scott, but so keep your mind on that.
I wrote my question down so I don't forget. Well,
I should have wrote this one down because I've forgotten now. Your finishes, Patrick, seem to have a kick at the end. You do not slog in at the end. Somehow you have reserved something along the way. That seems to be your MO out there. That's much like Bronco Billy style, where he's out there and ends up with something left to go ahead and catch the field that's out there. Is that something? How do you do that?
There are certain days where I don't have that in the tank, where it's crazy risks, like at Carbon X, I think. But for me, my best. One of my superpowers as an ultra runner is my ability to eat. And I think a big part of me being able to move so quickly at the end of the race is I pump almost 400 calories an hour all day, and I can continue to do it pretty much all the way to the finish. And I don't think it's so much that I'm moving so much faster than I was earlier, is that I'm just maintaining the same pace when guys tend to hemorrhage time at the end of an event. If you look back at my splits, like, I'm not necessarily running any faster at the end of Western States than I was in Forest Hill, but guys that were maybe running, 7:30 pace in Forest Hill are now running 11-minute pace from Pointed Rocks to the finish. And I think that's how I'm catching guys, in these events. For me, it's just, I've always paced races like that, like whether it's a 10K or an 8K. Cross country or a marathon, I've always paced pretty much dead even with maybe a slight negative split. So it's just another one of those habits, where I've taught myself to do that over the years. And the more I run a race or the more I run a particular distance, I think the more risk I take. So I might not finish that fast next year, but my overall time might be a lot faster, or my placement might be better. Right. So.
I really like that term that you use, superpower. One of my superpowers, because I think we all have superpowers. I think every one of us is out there that's put a bib on has a superpower somewhere, or we wouldn't be able to do the race. And whether it's your stomach is a superpower, or maybe your feet are a superpower, it could be anything that holds together for you that's not a problem. I think that's can be considered. You slide that over to the superpower column. And I think it's good for us to all acknowledge that we have a superpower, and anybody that's listening or running or with a bib on, we have those. So we need to maximize that. We need to focus on that and let it be a strength for us, and not focus on all the things that maybe aren't quite super yet. So I love that term, super. One of my superpowers, and take
advantage.
Yeah,
put on the cape, man.
And I think we all have that cape somewhere. We just got to figure out what's written on the back of it.
That's right.
You mentioned that you do have an iron stomach and the ability to eat 400 calories an hour. What are you eating? Are you eating real food? You using gels? What are you eating?
I'm eating a little bit of real food, but I'm eating pretty much all Goo Energy Labs products with a little bit of real food supplement. So I like to, and I always say this to the athletes that I coach, is have an adaptable plan and have a plan set up from the get-go that changes every hour. And what I mean is, I always start my day with something like Goo Summit tea. Start with a tea that's caffeinated. That's a sports drink, of course, but it's a caffeinated, almost savory tea. Magda ran the entire race with it in 2015. And I add like a waffle to it to almost simulate like breakfast, where I have Summit tea and a Stroop waffle. The next hour have two Stroop waffles and pure water. The next 2 hours have gels. The next hour have tea and a waffle. So I'm constantly sort of changing throughout the day. And once I hit, say, maybe 15 miles, I start to add a lot of watermelon and salty potato chips. So those are the things I pretty much do all day, but I do them in this pattern that I don't just jam gels till I'm sick of gels. I do gels for a couple hours, then I change the medium of the calories, then I change back to the gels, so that all the foods, all the options my crew has for me on race day, I come in and they know the plan, but they know it could be altered in a minute, where I'm just like, tired of gels, want waffles. And everything's laid out and everything's there. So I always tell my athletes, like, stay super adaptable and have your three or four or five options there on the blanket by the drop bag when you get in the aid station. These are the things I could eat. What looks good right now? And I think if you inject things throughout the day, little bits of all of your mediums of nutrition, you know what's going to feel good right now and what's not. So I just change all day long. Sometimes I just go straight sports drink for 5 hours, you know, but yeah.
Have you ever had your stomach go south on you in one of these long events?
Maybe a little queasy, but not south. No.
So that's a no, Scott, because he would have hesitated if he had lost it totally.
You and I have nothing in common, Patrick. Nothing.
Including finish times.
Including finish times. I saw an interview that you did where you were talking about splits and how, as you're looking at your GPS watch, that you're not paying attention to splits. You're looking at the average pace. Can you explain that and why you do that? What is the advantage of doing that?
Yeah, so I have my watch set up in such a way where it doesn't give me my mile splits. But I can look down at any time and the entire run is one big split. So if I look down at mile 2 and it says 7:10 a mile, and I look down at mile 50 and it says 7:11 a mile, I know, man, I've been running a pretty linear pace, give or take, all day long, including my aid station stops, including everything. I'm about to get a big climb. Don't panic if you get to the top and it's 7:17 a mile, because then you're going to have a big descent through El Dorado and you're going to be back to 7:11 a mile. So I think that for me, coming from roads onto the trail in particular, it would always stay linear on the roads for a 100K road race because I'm never stopping, right? Like, I'm coming through the aid station. If I'm losing time, I'm slowing down a lot. But on the trail, I think coming from a road background, it's a really good thing to have it set up that way, because then you're able to just check in every hour or two or 30 minutes, whatever you're comfortable with, and say, cool, I'm still on track. For me, it's too much information to get a split every single mile. It would just stress me out. Whereas, like, I'm eating something every 10 minutes. That's where I focus all of my mental energy. That and just, like, perceived exertion and lines of play on, like, should I hike this? Should I run this? You know, should I bomb this descent? Or is this somewhere I should be careful? Removing the stress of, like, the splits every mile allows me to focus on the things that, in my opinion, matter in the moment, you know?
What about splits between aid stations? Do you have your spreadsheet of between this aid station and this aid station, I should be at this split?
I have it for my crew, but I don't have it written anywhere, and I don't even remember it when I'm coming through. So great. My crew, the only purpose of that is so my crew knows about when to expect me. And I haven't been in a situation where my crew's like, hey, like, you're way behind or you're way ahead of your splits. That's information, like, I don't want from them. Mm-hmm. Once I'm out there, like, I don't really think too much about time or pace or care what the time at the end of the race is necessarily. Especially when I've done a race for the first time, you know? Like, mm-hmm. Maybe next year, come the Western States, I'll know, okay, I want to, you know, I passed through Forest Hill in 16th this year. Maybe next year I want to pass through Forest Hill in 7th or 8th. So what split, based on the weather of that day, based on the weather in the high country, would make sense based on last year in order to make up that time, you know? I think I'll think about it for states a little bit more next year, just because now I have a barometer, like, I have a baseline gauge of where I should be if I want to be at least third by the finish, right? So
I want to go back to the comment about the split time miles versus overall time. And I'm with you on that, because I've done that with I'm just sharing this experience so we can all relate to it, maybe talk about it, is that it's a big distraction for me to be able to say how much time, like you said, 7:11 or 7:17, don't be worried. am I at the base of the hill? I kind of predict that. What's it going to be? What? So I give myself permission for it to be 717. And then I distract myself because I want to see how accurate I am. And I just kind of run it through. So anything that I can take away from what's actually happening, like on my big toe or my, you know, whatever might be bothering me at the time, it really is a great mental distraction. So I think it's
absolutely,
it's a puzzle.
I agree with you completely. Absolutely. And that you need to be focusing on other things. Mm-hmm. Numbers shouldn't matter all that much to us, you know, with the exception of making sure you're making cutoffs and everything. I don't think the numbers matter nearly as much as paying attention to what's going on with your body. That's what it comes down to, is remove all the information that is just going to stress you out so that you can focus on what's going on with your body in that moment.
Mm-hmm. Patrick, let me give you a little insight to my friend Don over here that says he doesn't watch that and he doesn't care about that.
I have no idea what's coming up next, Patrick.
It's the reason why is because my friend Don is a time savant.
This
is one of the things that I really enjoy about Don is he can tell you if we're running, he'll say, I say, what pace are we running? And he can be within 2 seconds of our pace that we're currently running. Or if we're... I've gone out on very, very long runs, many multiple hour runs, and I'll say, how long have we been running? And without him looking at his watch, he'll say, we've been out here for 2 hours, 36 minutes, and 27 seconds. And I don't know how he does it. Actually, I do, because he's behind me running and he looks at his watch and says that he doesn't. But he's within a couple minutes. It's uncanny how he knows where the sun is in the sky and what the wind's blowing. I don't know how he does it. So he doesn't need a GPS watch.
He's giving me a little too much credit. And it's always good to embellish your story, Scott. So that's great.
Hey, Patrick, you had mentioned, and I want to get back to this. We're kind of going back on the trail from where we were. You mentioned that Western States sounds like, if I may put words in your mouth, is your A race for 2020, and you're building your schedule around Western States. Can you talk about how you build your schedule? What's involved in that? Talk to us about that.
Yeah. My schedule here is a little, like, based on where I live, I build my schedule probably a little differently than runners in colder climates do. So I usually have a period where I sort of shut down towards the end of the summer and take a break. Like this year in particular, I took a big break in July. So I almost have two seasons compared to someone's usual, maybe one season, where they start running ultras in say March and they're done running ultras in October. I almost have a shutdown period in the middle of the summer. So rather than my year ending in December, my year kind of, the first half of my year kind of ends in July, and I start back up a second season, and that season usually ends in like December or January. So the way I've built my schedule this year around States is I picked Javelina, which is a pretty big spread from States. And 6 weeks after Javelina, I'm signed up for another 100. So I might do Javelina into Brazos Bend, and then I'll take a nice break in the remainder of December. But I'll get racing again as early as February of next year. I'm likely going to do Tarawera in February. And then I have a couple options in late March or April with Western States Training Camp and then Western States. So this year in particular, I built a schedule that made sense for both Project X and Western States. So I did Way Too Cool. Well, I did Dufusky Island 40-mile road race in January. I did Way Too Cool in March, Project X in May, and then Western States in the summer. And I really just focused on training through all of my races in January, February, March, building marathon-type fitness in April for Carbon X, and getting the majority of my climbing in both in the month of March and the month of May and early June for Western States. So this year was quite different than I'll build my schedule next year because Carbon X was such an important event. But next year I have the option to say, hey, from January 1 all the way until the last weekend in June, I can focus on Western States. So this year I'll really focus on gradually improving my fitness as we get closer and closer to States. Like, nothing will matter more than States in the first half of next year. So that's exciting, you know, and you have the option as a runner to say, I could race a lot here. I'm already in States. It doesn't matter. I can go race all over the place, or I can really just hone in and focus on that event. And for me, I think throughout the season, this year in particular, I don't think I looked too fit until early May, which was a really good thing for my Western States this year.
How important are races building up to your A race? Do you think that you need to have other races in there, or can you just do training runs?
I think you can just do training runs, but I think it's important to, I don't know, for me, it's important to have one or two confidence boosters, you know, a check-in every 8 to 12 weeks to just see how's it going? Where are you at fitness wise? Where's my descending speed right now? Where's my climbing speed, my ability to power hike efficiently and quickly? I think it's important to have at least two of those that are more B races in the build to something like States. Because I just don't like to go into the race dry and not having raced, you know?
Can you go into a race giving yourself permission to go slow, for instance, not make it an A race, not finish on the podium, just to go out there and check certain things about your race? Are you okay with that psychologically to not PR everything?
Yeah, I'm okay with that. I mean, this year, Way Too Cool had that purpose where Way Too Cool was a C race. And then the day after Way Too Cool, I did I was hammered, but I did the Cal Street leg the day after Way Too Cool. So I ran from Forest Hill to the river with Scott Wolf the day after Way Too Cool, and I was destroyed from Cool, but I was able to race Cool in such a way that I was able to do that the next day. And me and Magda institute a lot of those type of opportunities where if it's less than 100K, I don't mind racing it at say more like a threshold or like an 85% type effort. Cause my focus is definitely way more 100K to 100 miles.
Way to Cool is not an easy 50K.
Whew, it's not an easy 50K. and there are so many crushers there. I couldn't reel those guys in over 50K distance the way that I feel like I usually reel guys in 100K. I mean, that race is so hyper-competitive.
It really is. And it attracts a lot of talent. And you would probably be better off with a second loop making it a full 100K to wear some of those guys out.
Oh, I think so. Yeah, I think, I don't know about this year. I don't know if I'd have much rather 100K on that course than this year's huge rainstorm.
There was a lot of mud out there this year, wasn't there?
Hey, you mentioned earlier a break, and I'd like to define that break. What does that break look like? Is it, how long is it, and how off are you? Do you throw away the running shoes, or you know, do you do some other cross training? Tell us about your break.
Yeah, after a 100-mile race in particular, I utilize Pam Smith's formula. Pam told me a couple years back, we were chatting about, you know, recovery, and we were on the horn chatting a little bit about, you know, how she'd recovered from Western States and some of her marquee races that she's had over the course of her career in her build to her next one. And she said that her system was to take a day off for every 10 miles of racing. So what I now do when I have an A race like Western States or Carbon X, I take a day off for every 10 miles of racing. So for Western States, the 10 days out after, I just hang out, walk, kayak, you know, whatever me and my wife may do, after a race, she'll usually come in crew. So we were on Lake Tahoe and kayaking a couple times up there, walking around the lake, you know, maybe walking a little bit on trails, but trying to keep it as flat as possible and just keep some active recovery in there. In the next 2 weeks, I'll slowly build back into running where I'll just do easy, 4 to 6 mile jogs, for maybe the next 10 days. So really the 20 days after 100-miler, I'm not doing too much training. And I'm trying to keep it as much as possible on soft surface, just grass field, flat grass fields or flat non-technical trails. So I'd say 20 days of slowly building back into training after 100. And even 100K, like if I go to do something like Comrades, I'll take a good 6 or 7 days of absolutely no running.
So we've talked a bit about the physical side, but what about the nutrition side? Do you focus on those 20 days of eating differently to recover and repair yourself?
Yeah, I'll particularly eat a lot of really good fats and reduce carbohydrate a whole lot. And reducing in particular gluten from the diet, just because it's just such a natural inflammatory. So as much as possible, I'll reduce gluten intake, and I'll increase like the number of avocados I'm eating per day, the amount of nut butter, the amount of like really good lean meats. I'm not a vegetarian, so I'll hammer really good steak or really good local red meat that's sourced well during that period. And like here we have great seafood, so like we'll be eating like pretty buttery, pretty fatty meals in the week after a race, and that seems to always be a big help and advantage for me to increase protein intake and fat and decrease carbohydrate.
Do you count calories at all during with your athlete diet?
I don't calories. I do know like what a good baseline is for me each day. Like I can pretty easily think about, did I have enough calories today, or you know, am I on track for the right number of calories per day as I'm going through the day, just based on how I'm feeling cognitively and energy wise. I try to institute like 3 pretty solid meals along with a couple snacks and like maybe like 1 or 2 small smoothies throughout the day. So, yeah.
Do you know your race weight?
Roughly. I rarely weigh myself, but I'm probably about 137 to 140.
Wow. So during the training year, how far off do you get from that 137, that race weight? Are you typically, 5 pounds over, 10 pounds over, or do you stay right around that range? You don't fluctuate.
Right around, maybe 2 pounds up, 3 pounds up, something like that. Yeah. Sometimes when I stop training, I actually go down. It's interesting. I think my appetite goes down in such a way where like I have that barometer of how much I should be eating each day based on how much activity I'm doing. And I think just due to like losing a little muscle mass after an ultra, like my race weight or my weight actually goes down. And I find that if I do frequent measures with my friend who's a physiologist in the area, we go back up as we get into more intense training. So it's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I just use the old pinch above the belt line test to see where I'm at.
Yeah,
I like to do that.
That's about 3 extra pounds there. Yeah.
Hey, Patrick, you have a degree in exercise science. What are some of the things that you've learned practically as a runner that you didn't learn in college?
Oh man.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question, Scott.
Thanks, Don.
Yeah. I mean, did you learn more at school or learn more on the trail?
You're skewing my good question.
Yeah, it was so good.
You had to change it.
It stumped Patrick. I was just helping him.
I think I've learned more in life in general, on the trail or on the road or whatever you may call it, than I did in school from a practical standpoint, But I think what I learned at university, it gave me the baseline knowledge to understand what I was learning in the real world. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
In real life, everyday life. I definitely had a super solid education at The Rock and, good professors. Like my advisor was actually the head physiologist at Badwater for 10 years. So I learned a lot from him. And he kind of gave me the ultra bug. And I mean, at that time I would have never thought I'd run anything over 10K. Right. But, we just reconnected recently. I spoke up at Slippery Rock like 10 days ago at my alma mater, and Jeff organized the talk and introduced me and everything. And it's kind of funny how you go so full circle. And you remember all those things that person taught you in life at university. So yeah, probably more after university. Yeah. I think you just learn more by putting yourself out there and experience in life. Like, you can read as much about ultramarathon as you want to, but until you run your first 50K or 50 miler or 100K, 100 miler, man, you don't know shit, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You don't know what your superpowers are or your kryptonite. You don't know. You don't know. But one thing is for sure, you have a little of both.
Yeah.
Even the people on the podium have some kryptonite that they have to avoid. What's your kryptonite?
Oh, the 50K.
That's a big. That's a meteor. That's not just a little piece of stone. That's a partial planet.
Man, that distance. I don't know. Maybe extreme cold. You know, I don't know. I don't know how I do racing in absolutely bitter, you know, sub-zero degree temperatures for an ultra. I mean, I've never done that.
Arrowhead 135 up in Minnesota with a
Polk.
A Polk behind you, yes.
That may not be the deal. That's what the poles, right? You have the PVC pipes with the sled.
Yeah.
Is that the Polk?
Right, that's the Polk.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I don't know about Arrowhead 135, you know?
But you never know. You never thought about a 100-mile race through the mountains, so...
Yeah,
you don't know where you're going.
Your first 100K, you were surprised. So maybe this Arrowhead, what do they call that up there? There's a tagline for the Arrowhead. Anyway, I don't know what it is. I know it's pretty darn cold.
Yeah, for now I'll leave that one to Pam Reed. That's her deal. So I'll leave Pam Reed to Arrowhead 135.
You know what I've enjoyed about this conversation is you have brought up many mentors that have helped you along the way. You've of your lessons, of some of your strengths, things that you've learned. You've brought on names, and you know, Zach Bitter and Pam Reed and others that have really helped you find your way to where you are now. And I think that's pretty cool.
Thanks. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot to learn from everybody, and not only elite runners, but I feel like I've learned so much from all sorts of people in the sport that have taught me, hey, you know, don't do too many of these a year, or you know, be very careful about that high a volume. It's not sustainable. You know, when I first got into the sport and had seen a couple little injuries, maybe due to extremely high volumes. I mean, there's something to learn from everyone in the sport, whether they're an ultra runner or a former ultra runner or just a good aid station captain, you know? So,
and the beauty of this community is that everybody is willing to share. There's nobody that's hoarding their intellectual property. You know, you can call up Pam Smith and say, "Hey, Pam, how do you recover? How do you take a break?" And she's more than willing to get on a phone and talk to you about it. That's what I love about it.
Totally.
What I liked is you called it a horn, and I've called it a horn in the past. You said, "I'm on the horn with Pam," and I've used that term. So maybe we're related somewhere, Patrick. Maybe somewhere in our lineage, we have a connection, because I love that term. Get on the horn.
Yeah, I think so, Don. Yeah, for sure, man.
Hey, Patrick Regan, thank you for joining us. You can learn more by going to his website, patrickreganrunning.com. He's a coach, and he does take some athletes. So if you're interested in some of his training philosophies, you can reach out to him at patrickreganrunning.com.
One of the things, you don't have to count calories. You can eat great steaks if you want. You get to take some time off after races.
You don't have to pay attention to splits.
Yeah, there's a lot of things to like about his philosophy.
You can eat steak.
Yeah, that's right. Hey, Patrick, thanks so much. And good luck at Western States coming up. Because like you said, it's just around the corner. So it'll be fun to watch you there. And we look forward to catching up with you out there.
Thanks, guys. Really appreciate you having me on today. It was a fun conversation.
It was.
Go out and run
Moss.